Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Timon of Athens, Act 5. To promise is most courtly and fashionable. The poet and the painter pay their final respects to Timon in hopes of pulling off one last grift. In Act 5, Scene 1, Timon tricks the poet and the painter into revealing the venality of their purpose in visiting him, and then runs them off the premises. But before they're kicked to the curb, these two grifters with quill and brush make a couple of statements worth mentioning. The first is that the times suit not performance but mere promise-making, which the painter says, quote-unquote, opens the eyes of expectation. Furthermore, he says, except among, quote-unquote, the plainer and simpler kind of people, the deed of saying is quite out of use. To promise is most courtly and fashionable. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 23 through 26. This kind of talk could almost be taken from some Victorian proponent of fin de siècle overturning of moral earnestness and realism. Except, of course, that Oscar Wilde and his so-called decadent companions were engaging in a legitimate critique of their societies, and our dear poet and painter really aren't. They are simply parasites. Then there is the poet's intention of promising Timon a fine satirical representation, quote-unquote, a personating of Timon himself that would amount to, quote-unquote, a satire against the softness of prosperity, with a discovery of the infinite flatteries that follow youth and opulency. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 32 through 34. Let's call this something like a premonition of William Hogarth's 18th century series of paintings titled A Rake's Progress, which follows the downfall of a young gentleman when he proves unable to stay away from prostitutes, strong drink, and gambling. The strange thing is, the poet seems to intend his promise of such work more as flattery than condemnation. So what kind of gesture is the artist engaging in here? It resembles the one made by the conspirator Decius Brutus in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, who says that he will draw the reluctant Caesar to the capital on the Ides of March by the following strategy. Quote unquote, when I tell him he hates flatterers, he says he does, being then most flattered. Norton Tragedy's Julius Caesar, Act 2, Scene 1, lines 207 through 208. Let four words go by and language end. Timon torments the desperate Athenian senators and prays for the general extinction of humankind. In Act 5, Scene 2, a pair of Athenian senators come to Timon's seaside cave for gold, only to find that the newly minted misanthrope is impervious to bribery, flattery, and appeals to leniency and fairness. The interesting thing in this scene is Timon's way of responding to all these vain appeals. Above all, it's clear that he's toying with the senators, deliberately filling them with hope and then cruelly returning to his savage condemnations of Athens and all humanity. But most noteworthy, perhaps, are Timon's repeated references to the apathy that reigns in his thinking about other people's suffering. Oddly, this apathy is something about which Timon seems genuinely passionate. How can a person be passionately apathetic? Timon conjures up the worst outrages against civilians during war, and then says simply, quote-unquote, I care not. Act 5, Scene 2, line 62. Timon's last trick in this sadistic vein is his reference to a tree in his compound that he means to cut down soon. He claims to have a way for Athenians to cure what ails them. Quote-unquote, whoso pleased to stop affliction, let him take his haste. Come hither, ere my tree hath felt the axe, and hang himself. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 94 through 97. With that, the senators realize that their mission is hopeless. There will be no help from Timon's quarter. Timon's final prayer is a call for his own personal extinction, along with everyone else's. Quote-unquote, Lips let four words go by and language end. What is amiss? Plague and infection mend. Graves only be men's works and death their gain. Sun, hide thy beams. Timon hath done his reign. Act 5, Scene 2, Lines 105 through 108. This can't even accurately be called nihilism, since, after all, nihilistic prescriptions are usually intended to pave the way for future action, future meaning. Timon's call is closer to Macbeth's summation of life as, quote-unquote, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Norton Tragedies, Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 26 through 28. Some beast read this, there does not live a man. Timon dies in misery and bitterness, and Captain Alcibiades marches on Athens. The city is on edge. In Act 5, Scene 3, all attempts to move Timon in the matter of Athens fail, and he finally takes his leave of the world. The senators fearfully withdraw within the Athenian walls, awaiting attack by the embittered Alcibiades. In Act 5, Scene 4, one of Alcibiades' soldiers discovers Timon's tomb. He's able to read and notice that Timon has stashed near the tomb. Quote unquote, Timon is dead. Who hath outstretched his span? Some beast read this, there does not live a man. Act 5, Scene 4, Lines 3 through 4. Alas, Timon seems to have forgotten all about his steward Flavius, whom he had confessed to the gods to be at least one honest person in the world. The soldier takes a wax imprint of the tomb's inscription for Alcibiades, since he himself can't read the language in which it's written. Seek not my name. A plague consume you wicked caitiffs left. Alcibiades must decide whether to follow the path marked out by Timon's scathing, murderous contempt for the whole of Athens. In Act 5, Scene 5, Alcibiades approaches Athens and halts outside the city's walls. He sets forth his sense of grievance against his native town and seems determined to attack. But in the end, the senator's pleas for mitigation of harm sink in, and he agrees not to engage in the usual indiscriminate mayhem that ancient armies often practiced against defenseless enemies. In Timon of Athens, neither Timon nor Alcibiades is a well-developed character, so it is not entirely clear why the captain should take up Timon's grievances as his own, which he in part does, or why the lawful condemnation of one of his own soldiers for manslaughter should lead him to attack his native city. But a deep resentment of others' ingratitude may lie at the heart of the matter. Perhaps that's all it is. These questions aside, however, there is matter in Alcibiades' prompt acceptance of the Athenian terms for surrender. The play is a tragedy, but it does not end in what could have been unrestricted violence swallowing up the world it has conjured for us. The incensed captain softens his wrath, agreeing to accept delivery of those within the city walls, who the authorities determine have genuinely harmed him and Timon. In truth, only Timon has died, and Alcibiades reads to us the sour-spirited final words of the once great Athenian lord. Quote unquote, here lies a wretched corpse of wretched soul bereft. Seek not my name. A plague consume you wicked caitiffs left. Here lie I, Timon, who alive all living men did hate. Pass by and curse thy fill, but pass and stay not here thy gate. Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 70 through 73. Implicitly, Alcibiades rejects Timon's call for general destruction, even though, unlike Timon, he has the power to inflict it. It's hard to miss the contradictoriness of seek not my name and here lie I, Timon, but in any event, Timon has not wavered. He has held on to an experience-based misanthropy to his bitter seaside end. What to make of it all, this strange riches to rags and imprecations, career and lonely death, of one Timon of Athens. That Timon alone among the play's key characters dies may indicate that his story does not bring us a viable stance toward life, or a sustainable way of regarding life's meaning. It's common to expect that tragic protagonists' insights, however terrible the cost to the characters themselves, are worth something to them and us. But that value may not be available as a dignity-preserving, sustaining takeaway from Timon of Athens. It's a strange play, a tragedy, but unique in its means and in its effects upon us. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Saturday, June 21st, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.